questions without notice. Are there any questions? I give the call to the honourable member for Lindsay.
My question is to the Minister for Climate Change and Energy. Western Sydney food charity Mamalana's may close down due to their energy bills increasing by $900, according to media reports.
Order.
Founder Lana Borg said, quote, "The government needs to do more. It's disgusting that we're being slapped with higher costs after being promised cuts." When will the minister admit that the Albanese government's disastrous renewables-only energy policy is leading Australia in the wrong direction?
Order. Order. The Treasurer will cease interjecting. The member was heard in silence. The minister will give him the same courtesy.
Well, thanks,
the Minister for Climate Change and Energy has the call.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. I thank the honourable member for her question, and she asked about the government doing more. Well, perhaps the honourable member might have voted for bill relief, Mr. Speaker. Might have been a good start. Perhaps the honourable member might have voted for coal and gas caps, which were one of the factors in yesterday's announcement of reducing energy prices, including in Western Sydney. As I said yesterday, Mr. Speaker, I would have thought any honourable member would welcome the announcement yesterday of reductions in energy prices. A lot more to do. No one should be complacent. No one should suggest that there aren't pressures in the system, Mr. Speaker. But honourable members can suggest that the government could and should do more. Honourable members could have voted to do more when they had an opportunity, including the member for Lindsay, who voted against bill relief for her constituents and voted against coal and gas caps, which helped her constituents. So, Mr. Speaker, in relation to Endeavour Energy, as I said yesterday a 1.9% reduction.
Members on my left, the member for Barker will cease interjecting. Minister, in continuation.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. A 1.9% reduction, up to a 7.1% reduction for residents, and a 4.4% reduction for small business. It's a welcome sign. Of course, there's more to do, and there always will. And as we do more, I doubt we'll get any support from the member for Lindsay or her colleagues.
Before I call the member for Haslach, I am delighted to inform the House that present today in the Speaker's Visitors Gallery are members of the Parliamentary Partners Group, and I welcome all of our family and friends to Parliament today. Give the call to the honourable member for Haslach.
Thank you, Speaker. My question is to the Assistant Treasurer and Minister for Financial Services. What is the Albanese Labor government doing to help Australians manage the cost of living? And what is standing in the way of Australians earning more and keeping more of what they earn?
Give the call to the order. With no interjections before I call a minister. Give the call to the minister, the Assistant Treasurer and the Minister for Financial Services.
Thanks, Speaker. Can I thank the fabulous member for Haslach for her question? As she knows, 84% of residents in her electorate are going to be better off under the Albanese Labor government's tax plans. That's an average of $1,677 each better off, and that's a sensational tribute to your great work, the member for Haslach, in advocating for these policies. And of course, dealing with the cost of living includes ensuring that we get wages moving again and ensure that Australians can earn more and keep more of what they earn. And I can inform the member for Haslach and the House that the Albanese government is doing a hell of a lot to achieve both of these things. Wages are growing faster than ever. It's not an accident. It is the result of good policy, particularly low-paid workers, better bargaining arrangements. Well, under them, it was a deliberate design feature to keep wages low. Under us, it's a deliberate design feature to get wages moving again, and it's working. They don't like it, but it's working. I also want to take the opportunity, if I may, Mr. Speaker, to congratulate the member for Petrie on his appointment to the position of Shadow Assistant Treasurer. 300 days, we waited a long time, but I do want to take this opportunity to congratulate him and to inform him that 87% of his electorate are better off under the Albanese government's arrangements.
Order.
About $1,479 better off.
For Hume,
I wanted to know where the Shadow Assistant Treasurer stood on the issues of income tax reduction. So I looked at his website.
Order. The minister will
document here, which I'd
not
like
use
to,
props during question time, or he will be sat down.
And I won't, Mr. Speaker. But a helpful guide to where the member for Petrie and his government, his opposition, stand on income tax reduction. I looked at the section on those earning less than $45,000 a year under his plan. Absolutely nothing. $804 worse off. Every one of those people in his $804 worse off. I looked at how
Order.
Much somebody on $100,000 a year
Order.
Would be
the member
under
for
his
Groom
plan.
Will cease
$1,375. $804 worse off. I looked at how much somebody on $80,000 a year would be on. $875 versus $1,679. $804 worse off. Deputy Speaker, I went through all of the scales. On average, $804 a year worse off. We've waited a long time for a shadow assistant treasurer. He's probably going to achieve the unachievable, and that is to make Stuart Robert look good.
Before I call the member for Moncrief, the member for Groom interjected 11 times during that answer. It's order. If he wishes to keep interjecting, he won't remain here for the remainder of question time. Give the call to the honourable member for Moncrief.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Climate Change and Energy. In the last 2 years, electricity bills in southeast Queensland have increased by up to $622. The minister repeatedly promised to cut prices by $275 a year, yet in southeast Queensland, Labor has fallen short of its election commitment by up to $897. If the minister can't guarantee this reduction, will he admit that he was wrong and apologise to struggling Australian families?
Call to the Minister for Climate Change and Energy.
Well, thanks, Mr. Speaker, and I appreciate the question from the honourable member. And she asked about promises on electricity prices. She asked about promises politicians make on electricity
Order.
Prices, Mr. Speaker.
Order.
And I understand.
Order.
The I understand the sensitivity, Minister, Mr. Speaker.
Minister will pause. We are 14 seconds into an answer. I can't hear what the minister is saying. The leader of the Nationals is going to remain silent for the remainder of this question, otherwise he won't stay. 14 seconds. The minister now has 2 minutes 46 seconds, and I give him the call.
Thanks, Mr. Speaker. Of course, it's not unusual for promises to be made about electricity prices. For example, the member for Hume in the 2019 election promised a wholesale price of $70 a megawatt hour, Mr. Speaker. And he says, oh, look, it's below it. Well, it is now. It is now, Mr. Speaker. That is true. But on the day of the 2022 election, Mr. Speaker, it was $286 a megawatt hour, Mr. Speaker.
The minister will pause. Just want to remind the member from Moncrief, there's only one point of order taken on relevance, so I'll hear what she has to say. It is early in the answer, but I'll give her the call.
On relevance, there was nothing in the question about coalition policies.
Resume
this was asking.
Resume your seat. The minister is unable to do some compare and contrast, but his answer cannot be all about the coalition and their policy. He knows that. And now that he has had 1 minute into the answer, there will be no more points of order on relevance, because that's already been done. So the minister has the call.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. And certainly I was and will continue to point out that when we came to office, the wholesale price of energy was $286 a megawatt hour after the member for Hume had promised it would be $70 a megawatt hour. And as of today, it is $64 a megawatt hour, Mr. Speaker.
That's less.
And that is less. It's less than $286. It's less than $70. And it's as a result of several things, including coal and gas caps that were put in place by this government, this Prime Minister, opposed by that Leader of the Opposition, who opposes absolutely everything he ever sees. It's a result of international pressures changing. It's as a result of more renewables in the system. Trigger warning, I mentioned renewables. I know it sends those off opposite, Mr. Speaker, but it's a statement of fact. Just a trigger warning to assist, Mr. Speaker. I'm always here to help, and we'll continue to do what it takes to put downward pressure on energy prices, while those opposite promised lower prices and delivered higher prices.
The member for Braddon will cease interjecting. I'd like to hear from the member for Higgins.
Thank you, Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Climate Change and Energy. What has been the response to the latest analysis from the CSIRO, which has once again confirmed that nuclear is the most expensive form of energy?
Order. Give the call to the Minister for Climate Change and Energy. Order. The Minister has the call. The member for Higgins was heard in silence. There's far too much noise. The member for O'Connor is not helping the situation. The Minister for Climate Change and Energy.
Thanks, Mr. Speaker. Probably should have had another trigger warning because we mentioned the CSIRO and science, Mr. Speaker. But I do thank the honourable member for Higgins, and what a difference she has made. What a climate leader she is in this House, Mr. Speaker. We welcome her presence in this House as a leader on climate action. Now, Mr. Speaker, as the honourable member referred to, the recent GenCost report by the CSIRO and AEMO has confirmed yet again, that renewables are the cheapest form of energy and nuclear is the most expensive form of energy, Mr. Speaker. This is consistent with findings overseas and has been consistent with continual findings by the CSIRO and AEMO. And I'm asked what the response has been, and the response from those opposite has been very disappointing. The member for Fairfax had a very interesting formulation. He said, well, renewables might be the cheapest form for energy investors, but not for consumers. So apparently energy is the only commodity in the world where if it's more expensive to build, the investors don't need to get a return on capital and it's not more expensive for consumers. The only one, Mr. Speaker, of all of them is energy. But that looks good. That looks good compared to the Leader of the Opposition, who chose to attack the CSIRO and call the report discredited,
order.
Mr. Speaker.
Order.
Which is to the discredit of the Leader of the Opposition as the alternative Prime Minister of Australia. He falsely claimed that GenCost doesn't count the cost of transmission, which is not true, and he should apologise to the CSIRO and AEMO. But this is all part of the Opposition's policy to introduce the most expensive form of energy, as identified in the GenCost report. Now, we've been on quite a journey with the Opposition over the last 2 years. For 2 years, they've been telling us they're going to introduce small modular reactors, which is what GenCost deals with. They kept telling us small modular reactors is where the action is, despite the fact we pointed out on multiple occasions they don't exist. It's actually a fiction, Mr. Speaker. There's no such thing as a small modular reactor. The Leader of the Opposition even said, said on the 5th of March 2023, I'm quoting the Leader of the Opposition. You might want to listen to this because, you know, I'm sure you want to hear what he said. He said, I don't support the establishment of big nuclear facilities here at all. I'm opposed to it. I'm opposed to it. Now we know their policy is big nuclear reactors. Now, Mr. Speaker, the Hinkley C big nuclear reactor, which is the poster child, has recently been costed at $86 billion Australian, Mr. Speaker, for one reactor. $86 billion Australian. Now, the Leader of the Opposition has finally got a plan for Australia. After 2 years of negativity, he's finally got a policy, he's finally got a plan. The bad news is it's an absolute stinker, Mr. Speaker. It's an absolute shocker. Nuclear is the wrong plan for Australia.
Before I call the next member, I've got a number of acknowledgements I'd like to do in the House. I'm pleased to inform the House that today, present in the gallery, is a delegation of state and territory board members from Auswege, including Bill Bulmer from the mighty electorate of Gippsland, the member for Gippsland tells me. Also, the 15 representatives from Grain Growers Australia, representing us from all across Australia as part of the Grain Growers National Policy Group's visit to the capital, and also members from the Eating Disorders Families Australia, including the former member for Higgins, Dr. Katie Allen, and Mayor Albert Jacob, and the CEO and Councillor Rebecca Pizzi from the City of Joondalup. Welcome to you all. Give a call to the honourable member for Warringah.
Speaker, to the Treasurer. Last budget, the government promised to support small businesses save on energy bills with electrification incentives and an instant asset write-off. You also promised to help households save on energy costs with the Household Upgrade Fund. Neither of these policies have yet delivered a single dollar to a single household or small business. With the next budget now coming, then what incentives, what will you do to make sure incentives flow to households and small businesses to help them electrify and save on energy costs?
The call to the Treasurer.
Yeah, thank you very much, Mr. Speaker, and thank you to the member for Warringah for her question and for her interest in this. This is obviously a key concern that the government shares. Part of the legislation that you refer to is in the Senate, before the Senate at the moment, and we want to see the Senate pass it because we want to back in small businesses and households when it comes to electrifying and getting their power bills down where they can. And so we have shown a willingness to pay tribute to the Minister for Housing, the Minister for Energy and others, Senator McAllister in the other place, for putting together what we think is a good combination of policy initiatives to help people do just that. You know, we want to give people the choice to electrify if they can. We want to make it more affordable. That's the motivation behind the legislation in the Senate, and we want to continue to work with the member for Warringah and others who want to see small businesses and families pay less on their power bills.
Give a call to the honourable member for Pearce.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Prime Minister. After a decade of neglect, how is the Albanese Labor government helping Australians to get the skills they need for good, secure jobs and keep more of what they earn when they enter the workforce?
The call to the Prime Minister.
I thank the fantastic member for Pearce for that question and for her concern about making sure that young people in Pearce get the skills they need, and also that people, older workers, retraining for new jobs of the future, get the skills that they need as well. And indeed, taking action on the cost of living is our number one priority, because we do want people to earn more and we want people to keep more of what they earn. Yeah. And that means we need to help more Australians get the skills they need to get a good, secure job, which is exactly what our fee-free TAFE policy does. Identifies areas of skill shortage and says that you can enrol for free. And today we have released new figures on what a success that program has been. Our initial target was 180,000 places in the first year. We smashed that target, Mr. Speaker. We had over 355,000 new enrolments across a range of industries where we have skills shortages, both blue-collar and white-collar industries, nursing and disability workers, technology and digital, construction and home building, childcare and education, agriculture and farming. As I've gone around the country and visited TAFEs, I've met many students who are so excited by engaging in what will be a new career with a good, secure job at the end of it, strengthening our economy, boosting key industries, and getting more Australians into good jobs. And that's what it means to support aspiration, to be the party of aspiration for all, not just those who have been successful, such as people in this chamber who earn a good wage, but every person who looks forward to working. And many of those TAFE students, of course, will be apprentices. They're on relatively low incomes, and that's why at that early stage in their careers. And that's why it's so important that our tax cuts deliver a tax cut for every Australian taxpayer, all 13.6 million of them, not just some, not just in some places, every part of the country, every part of our economy. Now, we're working for Australia each and every day. We're making sure that we preside over an economy which has seen real wages lift, that is putting that downward pressure on inflation, that is making sure that more jobs have been created under this government during our first 2 years, and we're not quite there yet, than any previous new government in Australian history. More new jobs created. But we'll continue to not be complacent. We'll continue to work each and every day in the interests of working Australians getting ahead.
Call to the Manager of Opposition Business.
My question is to the Prime Minister. Considering our Ambassador to the United States, Kevin Rudd's descriptions of Donald Trump as a, quotes, destructive president and, quotes, a traitor to the West, and given Mr. Trump's response today that Mr. Rudd is, quotes, not the brightest bulb, quotes, nasty, and, quotes, won't be there long, will the Prime Minister be reassessing Mr Rudd's position.
No,
as ambassador.
The manager will cease. There is far too much noise. This is not the time to interject. Members on my right, the manager of opposition business will be heard in silence. There's not going to be any additional comments made. You may have your opinions about the question. You can keep them to yourselves. The manager of opposition will start his question again.
My question is to the Prime Minister. Considering our ambassador of the United States, Kevin Rudd's descriptions of Donald Trump as a, quote, destructive president and, quote, a traitor to the West, and given Mr Trump's response today that Mr Rudd is, quote, not the brightest bulb, quote, nasty and, quote, won't be there long, will the Prime Minister be reassessing Mr Rudd's position as ambassador to our most important, or as Mr Farrell suggests, our second most important, strategic ally?
Order. Give the call to the Prime Minister. Order.
Why didn't you ask about a business standard, Fletch?
The Prime Minister has the call.
You asked about cars, Fletch?
Yeah. Prime Minister has the call. Order.
Thanks very much, Mr Speaker. I'm somewhat surprised to get that question from the manager of opposition business that says everything about the character of this current opposition.
Order. Members on my left, the member for Fairfax. Manager was heard in silence.
At a time when Australians are worried about the cost of living and a range of issues that affect their daily lives, they decide to politicise Australia's representative in Washington DC. Something that was never done by this side of the chamber when Arthur Sinodinos occupied that position, when Joe Hockey occupied that position, and when other representatives, including Alexander Downer, George Brandis and others as High Commissioner of the United Kingdom. Because one of the things that I have never seen happen before in 28 years in this chamber is an attempt to politicise Australia's representative overseas in an important nation such
order.
As that. Never seen it before.
Order.
Never seen it before. This is what the Leader of the Opposition
order.
Said.
The member for Fairfax is warned.
This is what the Leader of the Opposition said on the appointment of Mr Kevin Rudd, a former Australian Prime Minister as Ambassador to the United States. He said this: "We welcome the appointment of Kevin Rudd to the United States." When Joe Hockey, a predecessor, was appointed, he said this: "I'm sure the Americans will give him a warm welcome." Those opposite
order.
Know
order.
That whether it is Kevin Rudd in the United States or Stephen Smith, who is currently here as a result of the OCMI meetings as High Commissioner to the United Kingdom, who I hosted last evening, and I'll host the OCMI delegates, both the defence and foreign ministers, including former Prime Minister David Cameron, at the Lodge tomorrow, and be very proud to do so, is
order.
That when we engage, particularly with our AUKUS allies, the idea that we have a cheap shot question like that diminishes
order.
The opposition
order.
And
on
says
my left.
Everything about why this bloke is not fit to be the Prime Minister of Australia.
Order. Members on my right will cease interjecting. The member for Deakin will cease interjecting. Give the call to the honourable member for Bennelong.
Thank you, Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Transport. How will the Albanese Labor government's new vehicle efficiency standard deliver Australians greater choice of a cleaner, cheaper cars to run? And why has this important reform not been delivered sooner?
Give a call to the Minister for Infrastructure, Transport, Regional Development and Local Government.
Can I thank the member for Bennelong very much for the question, because he knows that there are substantial cost of living benefits to Australians by getting more efficient and cleaner vehicles into the Australian market. Now, people may not know, but the new vehicle efficiency standard, it's been on the books, frankly, as a policy idea for decades. It's been coalition policy for nearly a quarter of a century. John Howard went to the 2001 election promising that the Coalition is negotiating new fuel efficiency standards for motor vehicles to reduce the amount of fuel consumed per kilometre travelled. The most recent Coalition government, where the Leader of the Opposition sat around the Cabinet table, was committed to delivering an efficiency standard, with, of course, the member for Bradfield saying, although Australia accounts for less than 2% of the global new vehicle market, it is becoming increasingly important that we harmonise our approaches to vehicle emissions with those in place in other countries. And of course, yesterday, according to media reports, just as late as yesterday, the Leader of the Opposition told his party room that efficiency standards continue to be Coalition policy. Now, the Coalition, frankly, are all talk and no delivery. They are too scared of their own shadow to actually deliver on their own policies. When anything gets a little bit too hard, they crawl up into a ball. They are the scared, of Australian politics.
The minister will pause. The member for Barker, it's not the time to interject. You're warned. It's too much noise. I can't hear what the minister is saying. I'd ask the Leader of the Opposition to show some respect to every minister, just as I demand respect shown to him. So, the order. The Minister for Social Services and the Minister for Disability Insurance will cease interjecting. We're just going to order. We're just going to take the temperature down and ensure that this minister is heard. I need to hear what the minister is saying. I think every member needs to hear as well. I'll give her the call.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. As I said, those opposite are the scared, weird little guys of Australian politics, so fearful of anything that they are absolutely paralysed. Now, this government, of course, is getting on with the job of delivering for the Australian people, and our goal is to provide more choice of cleaner, cheaper-to-run cars for all Australians. An efficiency standard is important because it allows consumers to choose the right vehicle for them and their circumstances, and it incentivises car companies to deliver their best cars into the Australian market. It will help take the pressure off families by creating a greater choice of cars that are cheaper to run, whether they're petrol vehicles, whether they're diesel, whether they're hybrid or whether they're electric vehicles. It is particularly important in regional communities like mine because we stand to benefit the most from fuel savings for those vehicles. The Minister for Climate Change and I have been consulting. We've closed those consultations now. I've been talking to the Australian CEOs of car manufacturers, dealer representatives and motor clubs. We thank everyone for their constructive feedback because we know on this side of the House that is what good governments do. They consult, work through issues, deliver for Australian consumers, don't crawl up into a little ball and hoping that no one notices.
Minister's time has concluded. Give a call to the honourable member for Lyne.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Climate Change and Energy. The Isuzu D-Max is one of regional Australia's top-selling vehicles, but Labor's new family car and ute tax will increase prices by up to $13,800 on every car. Isuzu Ute Australia has stated the policy is excessive and many vehicle brands may be forced to increase vehicle prices to cover the penalties incurred. Why is Labor increasing family car prices in the middle of a cost of living crisis?
Call to the Minister for Climate Change and Energy.
Well, thanks very much, Mr. Speaker. I thank the honourable member for his question, and presumably he's raised it with the member for Bradfield, who pointed out when he was trying to introduce fuel efficiency standards that the price of no model will go up, as it hadn't in Australia, hadn't in any other country in the world, it wouldn't in Australia, and the impact on purchasing wouldn't change. And perhaps he was raising the same point when the former Treasurer, the former member for Kooyong, said just weeks before the last election on Insiders, and I quote, "The Liberal Party has always been committed to fuel efficiency standards, Mr. Speaker. Always been committed." And as the Minister for Transport just shared with the House, apparently the Leader of the Opposition is still committed. Funny way of showing it, but still committed.
Order.
Commitment means delivery. Now, what we are doing, as the Minister for Transport just said, is consulting on a preferred model with a wide range of stakeholders across industry groups and consumer groups to ensure we get the model right. That is what we're doing, because that's what good governments do. And then we will introduce the legislation. We will be voting for cost of living relief, which reduces the amount of petrol used by motorists, whether they choose a more efficient petrol vehicle, a more efficient diesel vehicle or an EV, because we want more choices available to the Australian people, not fewer choices. We want Australia to catch up with every other major economy in the world except for Russia. The Leader of the Opposition is happy to stay in the group of two, G2, Australia and Russia, when it comes to vehicle efficiency standards, and we are not.
I call to the honourable member for Lyons.
Thank you, Speaker. My question is to the Attorney-General. How is the Albanese Labor government acting to keep Australians safe from the threat of gun violence?
I call to the Attorney-General.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and I thank the member for Lyons for his question. Australia is proud to have some of the world's toughest and most effective gun laws, as well as some of the most responsible gun owners in the world. In the wake of the Port Arthur massacre, Australians vowed never again. Under the leadership of John Howard and Kim Beazley, leaders across the nation united to pass some of the strongest gun laws in the world. But we know there are still many illegal weapons in our community. Last year, the Australian Criminal Intelligence Commission estimated there were around 200,000 illegal firearms in Australia. The surrender of every single illegal or unregistered weapon makes our community safer. Today, the Albanese government has released the second permanent National Firearms Amnesty annual report. The report shows that in the last year, some 12,000 firearms and weapons and over 600 firearms parts and accessories have been permanently removed from the community as a result of the amnesty. The amnesty operates on a no questions asked basis. There is no risk of a fine and no risk of jail. And it's working, with 30,000 weapons surrendered since the amnesty commenced. I thank those who have participated to date, including the many responsible gun owners who've given up their unwanted firearms. The amnesty contributes not just to community safety, but to the safety of our police officers. The surrendering of illicit firearms reduces incidents of theft and the diversion of unwanted firearms to the black market. This success follows National Cabinet's landmark agreement in December last year to implement a national firearms register. For decades, law enforcement agencies have repeatedly raised the alarm about tracking the movement of firearms across state and territory borders. The establishment of a national firearms register will finally address this issue. It represents the most significant improvement in Australia's firearms management systems in almost 30 years. The National Firearms Register will keep our community safer from the threat of gun violence. It's a signature reform of the Albanese Labor government. And again, I thank all of those who have surrendered their weapons as part of the permanent amnesty. And for those that are still in possession of an unregistered or unwanted firearm, I encourage you to surrender it to help protect your family and your community.
Yeah. I call to the honourable member for Mallee.
Thank you, Speaker. My question is to the Prime Minister. The Prime Minister is taking this country in the wrong direction. Families and small businesses in my electorate are facing a 20% rise in electricity prices, along with higher gas prices as a result of this government's policies. Is the Prime Minister aware that farmers, food manufacturers and transport companies are facing the same price hikes and have no choice but to pass it on to consumers, which is why Australians are paying more at the checkout?
The order. The Prime Minister has the call.
Thank you. I thank the member for Mallee for her question. I'm asked to compare, really, whether the government is taking Australia in the right direction. And I'm happy to do so, Mr. Speaker, happy to do so. Because since we came to office, we have created more jobs, including in regional Australia, than any new government in Australian history. In areas like manufacturing, there's been almost 100,000 additional jobs created since we came to office. In the last two quarters, we've seen through figures from last week, we've seen productivity increase after such a decline under those opposite. We see record numbers of women employed full time. We see, when it comes to gender issues, we see the gender pay gap being the smallest it's been in Australian history, of just 12%. We see industrial disputes being lower than they were. The last figures available, 44,000 over the December quarter of 2023, compares with their last quarter in office of 128,000. We look at inflation. Inflation peaked under them in March 2022 at 2.1% in the March quarter, their last full quarter in office. What we saw in the December quarter was 0.6%. When it comes to energy prices, the June quarter of 2022, it was $264 a megawatt hour. Now it is less than around about a quarter of what that is. When it comes to gas prices, similarly an enormous drop as well. When it comes to private business investment, we see a higher private business investment occurring. The number of small businesses are now larger. And of course we see, when it comes to agriculture, when I visited Port Lincoln, looking at a shipload full of barley going to China. And today I will welcome the Foreign Minister of China, here, Wang Yi, who I will meet with immediately after question time. And one of the issues that we'll discuss is trade issues and the removal of any further impediments. But of course, to run an effective economy, you need to keep control of the budget. $78 billion surplus, deficit under them, $22 billion surplus under us.
Prime Minister's time has concluded. The call will go to the member for Tangney.
Thank you, Madam. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Treasurer. What progress has the Albanese Labor government made on the major economy challenges it inherited? And what does this mean for the budget in May? Thank you.
Call to the Treasurer.
Thanks, Mr. Speaker. What an absolute champion the member for Tangney is, and I appreciate the question. Mr. Speaker, when we came to office, inflation was high and accelerating. Real wages were falling. Interest rates were already rising. There were huge deficits, and there was more than $1 trillion in Liberal debt.
Order.
Under this government now, Mr. Speaker, this Labor government, inflation is moderating, real wages are growing again, the budget was in surplus last year, and there's less debt, which costs us less to service. By the time the Reserve Bank Board next meets, it will be 6 months without an interest rate hike. There is energy bill relief. There is cheaper childcare. There is cheaper medicines. There's more help with rent, and every taxpayer gets a tax cut on the 1st of July. And they don't like hearing it, Mr. Speaker, but here are the facts, as the Prime Minister just said a moment ago. Inflation under them, quarterly 2.1, under us 0.6. Inflation monthly under them, 6.1, under us 3.4. Wages growth, average annualised quarterly under them, a bit over 2%, under us 4%, Mr. Speaker. Real wages, come in, Spinner. Come in, Shadow Treasurer. What has real wages done, he says. What have real wages done?
Order,
under those opposite, real wages were negative 3.4%. And now they're growing again under this Labor government and under this Labor Prime Minister. Keep on chirping away, sunshine. Ask me about real wages. Ask me about real wages, Mr. Speaker.
Order.
And we turned a $78 billion deficit into a $22 billion surplus. And we turned gross debt from 45% of our economy into something closer to 35% of our economy. And that's why our responsible economic management has been backed in by the IMF and the OECD and the ratings agencies and the Reserve Bank governor, who said yesterday that monetary policy and fiscal policy are pushing in the same direction. Now, we know, Mr. Speaker, despite the progress that we're making, we know people are under pressure. We know that the economy is slowing, and we know that there's global economic uncertainty, and these are the three things which will define and determine our choices in the budget we hand down in May. Now, that budget will be all about relief, repair and reform. Cost of living relief, budget repair and reform of our economy to boost investment and grow our economy as well, Mr. Speaker, because we know that continuing to strike the right and responsible balance between relief, repair and reform is key to ensuring that our people earn more and keep more of what they earn. And we also know, Mr. Speaker, that those opposite have not learned a thing from a decade of economic mismanagement, which gave us stagnant wages, higher inflation, bigger deficits and much more debt. And we know that they haven't learned from it, Mr. Speaker, because even almost 2 years into opposition, they still don't have an alternative plan for the cost of living, and they still want Australians working longer for less.
Yeah. Order. The member for Bowman has been order. The Treasurer will cease interjecting. The member for Hume is going to be warned soon. I know you're responding, but don't take the bait. The member for Bowman is continually interjecting. He is now warned. So no more interjections from the member for Bowman. Give the call to the honourable member for Goldstein.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Treasurer. There are two positive economic steps that the government can take right now. Abolish the activity test, which limits subsidised early childhood education and care, and a wage increase for all early childhood educators. These measures would enable more children to access care, address the shortage of workers in the sector, enable more women to work, and boost productivity and the overall economy. Win, 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 win. Will the government take these wins for women in the budget?
Call to the Treasurer.
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Speaker. Thanks to the member for Goldstein for her question. We share those four objectives that you just mentioned in your question. And we do also see policy for early childhood education as care, as social policy, as well as economic policy. And we showed in our first budget, the biggest new commitment that we made in our first budget in October of 2022 was almost $5 billion investment in early childhood education. We saw that then, and we see it now as an important way to help families with the cost of living, benefiting something like 1.2 million families. We lifted the subsidy to 90% for people earning up to $80,000. We also made some admittedly modest, but I think important and meaningful changes to the activity test in that first round of reform that we did. And so I want to assure the member for Goldstein that I see policy in this area as important economic policy. I know the Prime Minister does, the Minister for Early Childhood does, the Education Minister does. We all see this as an opportunity to strengthen our economy. We want it to make it easier for more parents to work more and earn more if they want to. We want to make it easier for them to earn more and keep more. That's why 97% of early childhood educators will get a bigger tax cut from the 1st of July as well, Mr. Speaker. We also know, coming to the specifics of the member for Goldstein's question, we also know that there is more work to do in this area. We don't pretend that the important investments we made in the first budget or indeed the work that we have been doing for much of this term in office, we don't pretend that the job is done. We are enthusiastic supporters of the early childhood sector, and so we are examining other ways that we can strengthen the system. Whether it is the two measures that you mentioned there, whether it's this budget or the next budget, there is a willingness from the government to explore those issues that you talked about. We do want to boost pay for early childhood educators. They're doing such an important job. Many of us know from our own experience with the wonderful early childhood educators of this country how important they are. We want to see them paid more. We want to see them paid fairly. And we do acknowledge the arguments around the activity test as well. It's just a matter of finding room in a budget with all of our fiscal constraints. But there is a level of interest. We do not lightly dismiss the suggestions that you mentioned, and all the consultation that we do with the sector and with others to see if we can do better. At the end of the day, Mr. Speaker and the member for Goldstein, we want to see a sector which is well paid. We want to see a sector which recognises the important role that this plays in education and not just care, education and care, not education or care. and we see the care economy more broadly as an absolutely central part of our efforts to strengthen the economy into the future.
Just before I call the member for Werriwa, I'm pleased to inform the House that in the gallery today is the 2022 South Australian local hero, Monique Barham, alongside a group of individuals affected by lymphedema who were attending the launch of the Parliamentary Friends of Lymphedema. And also I note Ian Trezise, the former member from the Victorian Parliament. I see the Honourable Michael Fodius from the New South Wales Parliament here. Welcome to you all. I give the call to the Honourable Member for Werriwa.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Social Services. How will today's indexation of social security payments help Australian on income support manage cost of living pressures?
I give the call to the Minister for Social Services.
Well, thank you, Speaker, and I'd like to thank the member for Werriwa for her question and for the huge amount of advocacy she does for low-paid people in her community. Now, of course, the government recognises that many Australians are doing it tough at the moment because of cost of living pressures, particularly those on fixed incomes. And I'm very pleased to say today that around 5 million people will receive a boost to their social security payments as a result of income support indexation. Now, of course, regular indexation of payments is an important aspect of Australia's social security system. It is therefore to ensure that the income support payments keep pace. Now, today's indexation increases mean that there will be help for those that do rely on the safety net to deal with cost of living pressures. It does mean more money in the pockets of those doing it toughest. Now, from today, pensioners, people on the age pension will receive $1,116 a fortnight for singles and $1,682 a fortnight for couples.
Order.
Now, of course, parenting payment single recipients will see an additional $17.50 a fortnight. Now, this, of course, includes the more than 77,000 single parents, mainly women, who are also benefiting from the government's decision to expand the eligibility for single parenting payment until the youngest child turns 14. And of course, and I think the members will be interested on the other side for this, of course, this indexation is in addition to the action this government took at the last budget to boost working age payments by $40 a fortnight. $40 that you opposed. $40 that you on that side of the House opposed. Now, this base rate boost has been built by two subsequent rounds of indexation for payments like JobSeeker. In fact, the combined result of the $40 increase and the regular indexation since the Albanese government took office means that the base rate of JobSeeker has increased by $120 a fortnight. Of course, we're also indexing today the rates of Commonwealth rent assistance. This is occurring on top of the government's largest increase in Commonwealth rent assistance in 30 years. And of course, this will benefit over 1 million households. Now, these payments are just one of the many elements, whether it's help with energy bills, cheaper medicines, cheaper childcare, lifting the Medicare levy low-income thresholds, tripling of the bulk billing incentive, expanding the eligibility of the Commonwealth Seniors Healthcare Card, freezing social security and deeming rates, expanding paid parental leave and delivering the bigger, better tax cuts for working Australians. This government's getting on with the job.
I call to the Honourable the Deputy Leader of the Opposition.
My question is to the Prime Minister. On 7 December in the House last year, the Prime Minister said the National Reconstruction Fund was up and running. On 15 January, the Prime Minister said the NRF had been open for business from November and money was available now. But secret government documents reported in The Australian today reveal the funding application process for the NRF was only created after the Prime Minister made these claims. Why did the Prime Minister deliberately mislead this parliament?
Yeah, the Leader of the House.
Mr Speaker, the Deputy Leader knows full well that there are some statements that can only be made by direct resolution, I'd put that the question should be out of order completely. Like, that was eyes wide open. Breach of the standing orders.
The Deputy Leader of the Opposition knows that that remark wasn't part of the question. I'm just going to ask her to rephrase the last part of the question, to withdraw that part and just rephrase the last part. So a withdrawal and then a rephrase just for the last question.
Why did the Prime Minister deliberately not tell the truth to the Parliament?
Under the standing orders, you cannot make a statement. Well, I'm tempted just to rule the question out of order. So withdraw the last part of the question. If it's not in order, it's going to be ruled out.
I withdraw, Mr. Speaker. Can the Prime Minister please explain the inconsistency between the two statements he made?
Prime Minister has the call.
Thanks for your help, Mr. Speaker. I thank the Deputy Leader for her question. A seeking investment form was available on the NRF website from November. From November, the NRF Corporation was in ongoing discussions with a number of businesses about potential investments. The NRF was, by any reasonable definition of the term, open for business and was working with Australian industry. And indeed, by mid-January, over 160...
The Prime Minister will pause. The member for Bowman was told explicitly that he was on a warning and not to interject and is abusing the standing orders, and he'll leave the chamber under 94A. Prime Minister will continue.
Thanks, Mr. Speaker. By mid-January, over 160 businesses had already engaged with the NRF, had already engaged with them. Unlike the previous government, this government is getting on with delivery. We believe in industry policy. We believe in a future made in Australia. We support manufacturing, which is why 100,000 increased jobs is the figure when it comes to manufacturing jobs. Now, we passed this act that was opposed by those opposite, and held up for a while by some on the crossbench as well. But eventually, we got it passed through both chambers, and it is up and running. We passed the Act, we confirmed an investment mandate to help guide how the NRF Corporation should support Australian industry. The NRF Board has been appointed. The NRF CEO is already hard at work. The NRF Corporation is already working to secure a manufacturing future for this country. Unlike those opposite, who told the car industry to leave the country, with the consequences result of losing not just those jobs, but the multiplier that had an impact on in places like Geelong and in places like Adelaide, in places like Elizabeth, and all the car components companies that also lost, and the skills that were lost there. We believe in a future made in Australia. Yeah. We believe that we should be manufacturing solar panels here. We believe we should be manufacturing batteries here. We believe that a future made in Australia is linked directly to our national security, so we're not vulnerable to what happens overseas. That is what we're about. Those opposite continue to just get in the way, oppose all of these initiatives, and then say they haven't happened soon enough.
Give the call to the honourable member for order. The member for O'Connor is warned. He's had a good go, but he won't have any more lenience shown. The member for Solomon has the call.
Thanks, Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Employment and Workplace Relations. How have the Albanese Labor Government's enterprise bargaining reforms helped Australians to earn more and to keep more of what they earn? And what has the response been to these reforms?
Give the call to the Minister of Employment and Workplace Relations and the Minister for the Arts.
Thanks very much, Speaker. And I thank the member for Solomon for the question. And I'm pleased to say that the efforts that the member for Solomon and others on this side have made in voting for legislation that would make sure people earned more and kept more of what they earn. We saw live with workers I met with when we were recently up in Darwin in the electorate of Solomon. Just around the corner from Darwin Airport, there's a Bunnings. And people might not be aware of one of the changes from that Secure Jobs, Better Pay bill has now been a massive increase in the number of workers who are covered by enterprise agreements. There's now 150,000 additional workers in Australia covered by enterprise agreements who previously weren't, and 40,000 of those are workers at Bunnings. Now, these reforms have happened because when that legislation went through, we fixed the Better Off Overall test. We brought business. We made sure that businesses who'd let agreements lapse were brought back to the table, and we made arbitration possible so that industrial action was not the only way of bringing issues to a head by having an arbitration process available for intractable bargaining. Now, what did that mean for those Bunnings workers? $48 a week they're earning more. $48 a week more. And on top of that, they will get a $1,146 tax cut. The new Bunnings agreement for those 40,000 workers, and those opposite, everyone here has been to Bunnings, those opposite, yeah, well, you should start one.
Order.
Yeah, no, you should start one. Your slogan could be something like, I don't know, where lower wages are just the beginning. That would work for you perfectly. But the new Bunnings agreement, covering those 40,000 workers, has better rostering flexibility, improved leave entitlements, adult rates of pay at the age of 18 instead of 20, all there. And with the rostering changes, because often we just go straight to the pay improvements, the rostering changes have made a huge difference, rostering arrangements that weren't previously available. I met with one of the workers out the front of the store near that tool shop section that they have at the front of a Bunnings. And the bloke's name's Sonny, and he had switched his roster under a new right within the agreement where you can request it so that your roster gets reorganised, you get 3 days off in a row. He got it agreed to within a couple of weeks of asking, and I said to him, so what are you now doing with the time? Have you picked up another job? Have you taken up a hobby? What have you done? And his face just lit up and said, I'm spending every possible minute with my 11-month-old. These changes are possible when you get flexibility that works for workers as well into the industrial relations system. This is only possible because of legal changes that we supported and put through, and which those opposite have said they will target deliberately at the next election.
The call to the honourable member for Wentworth.
My question is to the Prime Minister. My community is deeply concerned about protecting all Australians from discrimination, no matter their gender, sexuality or faith. During the last election, a young trans person came to me, heartbroken at the exclusion they faced at school. They asked me to stand up for the LGBTQI community. Every day we delay action on discrimination law is another day a student could be excluded from school because of who they are. How can Parliament work together to strengthen protections for the LGBTQIA community as well as for people of faith?
Call to the Prime Minister.
I thank the member for Wentworth for her question and for her commitment, which I share, that no Australians should be discriminated against on the basis of their gender, their sexuality or their faith. This is something that has been discussed in this chamber prior to the member for Wentworth's arrival for some period of time. And I support religious liberty, and I think that it would be an important step forward if this parliament were to pass legislation to outlaw or to have the adoption of a religious discrimination bill. The government has prepared two pieces of legislation, religious discrimination bill and a Sex Discrimination Act amendment bill, to achieve the objectives of ensuring that people of faith can practice their faith free of discrimination, that religious-based schools can operate on the basis of their faith, including on employment issues. We have consulted widely, and I thank the Attorney-General for the consultation that's occurred with faith-based organisations. I've met with many religious leaders, including a roundtable in the middle of last year with a group of religious leaders. What I've said from the very beginning, including at that round table, was that there needed to be bipartisan support for this position. Because, as Senator Birmingham said this morning, I think it is a reasonable ambition to want to seek bipartisanship. If it is going to be passed through the Senate, given the nature, it needs the support not just of the government, but it needs the support of either the Coalition or the Greens political party. That's just the numerical facts of what is there. We will work with everyone, including the crossbenchers, on these issues. I have said, though, that we wouldn't go through a parliamentary committee process. Since 2016, there have been at least 10 inquiries. There's been over 260 hearings and consultations. There have been over 70,000 submissions to committees. It is now time to determine whether we'll progress forward or not. I'm up for progressing forward on the basis of a bipartisan position, and I hope that that can be achieved. If not, then that will be, of course, a decision for this parliament as well. I know that for so many Australians, the issues of discrimination are very central to them, and I thank the member for Wentworth for the way in which she has taken up these issues in such a considered and respectful way.
Give the call to the honourable member for Wills.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Environment and Water. How is the Albanese Labor government's environmental approvals process helping turn Australia into a renewable energy superpower, and what approaches has the government rejected?
Call to the Minister for the Environment and Water.
Thanks, Mr. Speaker, and I want to thank the member for Wills for his question. I know that he is a very strong supporter of renewable energy, as are his constituents in that seat of Wills. And Mr. Speaker, I'm delighted to report to you and to the House that the rollout of renewable energy is proceeding apace in Australia. In fact, since coming to government, we have ticked off more than 45 renewable energy projects, and I have another 128 before me for assessment. Now, the great news is, of those 45 renewable energy projects that we've already ticked off, that's enough to power about 2.5 million Australian homes. So some of the terrific examples I can point to, Mr. Speaker, are the 1,500 megawatt Yanco Delta wind farm that will generate enough electricity to power around 700,000 homes. That's in New South Wales. Or in Queensland, the Stony Creek wind farm, which will generate enough electricity to power about 100,000 homes. The other piece of good news, Mr. Speaker, is that the speed of approvals for these projects has just about doubled since we came to government. And it's not just renewable energy projects that we're assessing faster, it's all of those projects. It's the housing, it's the transport projects, it's the resources projects. All of the projects are being assessed faster because we've made it a priority for our government. Mr. Speaker, we know on this side that renewable energy is both cleaner and cheaper. Yeah. Australians have worked that out. That's the reason that more than 3 million Australian households have solar panels on their roofs. And Mr. Speaker, I was asked about alternatives. And the only alternative we have from those opposite, we had 22 energy policies when they were in government, didn't land a single one. They've now come up with number 23.
The member from New England will cease
and
rejecting.
It's nuclear power, which will be built in decades' time as soon as they've sorted out four little problems, as the Prime Minister pointed out yesterday. Safety, disposal, cost and location. But as soon as they've got that sorted, they'll be delivering those projects in the coming decades. Now, those opposite talk about cost of living pressures, and of course energy is one of those, for homes and for businesses. What kind of solution takes 20 years to deliver at a cost of $387 billion?
The member for Cowper was yelling throughout that answer. I reminded him earlier in question time that he was on a warning. He may have forgotten it, but I haven't. He'll leave the chamber under 94A. If you're on a warning, you will definitely not yell during an answer. The minister has the call.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I guess if I could ask a question, I'd say to the Leader of the Opposition, where will they go? How much will they cost? And how will you clean up after them?
Yeah. The call to the honourable member for Hume.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Prime Minister. Prime Minister, hundreds of thousands of Australian small businesses operate within family trusts. Can the Prime Minister guarantee that he will not impose a 30% minimum tax rate on discretionary trusts?
Give the call to the Prime Minister.
Thanks, Mr. Speaker. The Shadow Treasurer continues to sit there and dream up. What can I ask about what the Labor government isn't doing today? What can I just make up? And then the Leader of the Opposition can then jump in and go, well, will you rule it out? Well, the sun will come up tomorrow.
Order.
Sun will go down.
Order.
We have such an absurd position.
Order. The Prime Minister will order. The Leader of the Opposition is entitled to make a point of order, and he's got the call.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. Well, it's on relevance. We're up to question 7. The Prime Minister hasn't given a straight answer today. Could he give a straight answer on this?
Well, that was just an abuse of the standing orders. So the Prime Minister has the call.
He's very angry, Mr. Speaker. He's very angry. Always. We saw it yesterday in the chamber, and then we saw it in the press conference afterwards. Where he stood up and he said, we'll forget the fact that Michaela Cash, shadow Attorney General, did a Sky News interview and blew things up on Sunday. We'll forget the fact that she put in an op-ed in the West Australian.
Order.
An op-ed in the West
seat.
Australian. But why are you talking about religious
Steve's interjecting. The Prime Minister has the call.
I tell you who's talking about. And we get more abuse across the chamber, Mr. Speaker. More abuse. More abuse.
Order.
Always so angry, Mr. Speaker.
Order. Members on my left will cease interjecting.
I'm asked about tax and ruling things out, Mr. Speaker. Well, here's the member for Menzies for you. So could tweaks to negative gearing perhaps help younger generations? The member for Menzies. I'm not going to do the rule in, rule out of particular policies here. I think the problem with rule in, rule out, whether it's question time or here in the media, is I think we get focused in the 24-hour news cycle and not the problems that people send us here to solve. That's what they continue to say. When we talk about tax changes, I'm interested in what their view of negative gearing is, because the member for Canning said something to say as well.
Order.
He said, if the problem includes negative gearing, then we should make changes. We should make changes. The new Senator Kovacic, probably not backed by the leader, given his track record on pre-selections. We should not be afraid to consider tax changes. Tax changes,
order.
Whether that be capping the number of properties that can be negatively geared. And then their leader in the Senate, said this, Senator Birmingham, there are no doubt ways of looking at the tax and transfer system. That's what they've had to say. One by one, they're out there talking about all these issues. And of course, one of the favourites, Senator Rennick. Senator Rennick,
order.
Of
the
course,
Prime Minister's time has
it's nuts that
concluded.
We don't.
There was far too much noise during that question. I'd like to hear from the member for Cornwall.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Industry and Science. How will the Albanese Labor government's tax cuts benefit advanced manufacturing workers? What has been the response?
Call to the Minister for Industry and Science.
Thanks, Speaker. And I do appreciate getting a question from the co-chair of the Parliamentary Friends for Manufacturing.
Yeah.
And the member for Cornwall knows that the Albanese government is investing in a future for all Australians. We believe in a future made in Australia, creating more well-paid, secure jobs from our cities to our suburbs to our regions. Revitalising our manufacturing capabilities after the pandemic, absolutely crucial. And building up our advanced manufacturing capacity is also very vital. But to achieve this, we can combine world-leading Aussie know-how, our tremendous ability to develop emerging technologies, and also our abundance of natural resources. And it's terrific to see firsthand when I travel around the country, fantastic, innovative, advanced manufacturers proving that we can be a country that makes things, be it Formero in the electorate of Chisholm, that have the world, Australia's largest 3D printer, creating amazing prototypes for everything, including including medical devices. Vaxis in the electorate of Lilly, commercialising needle-free vaccination technology. And Device Technologies, who started in Warringah and opened their Western Sydney facilities last week with an ambition to manufacture more medical products here in Australia. And the work of the companies like these has a very real potential to change the way we live and, as I said, create secure, well-paying jobs. And it's why we're backing manufacturing workers with tax cuts.
Order.
So they can keep more of what they earn. For example, mechanical engineer earning $113,000, they're going to be $2,457 better off. An industrial designer earning $86,000 will be $1,657 better off, and a science technician earning $63,000 will be $1,357 better off. Workers who are literally the future of our nation, creating new products and opportunities, laying the foundations for generations to come, and they deserve, Speaker, a government working with them to build a better future. Unfortunately, what we see from those opposite is always nasty negativity, always talking things down, only ever talking about manufacturing when they want to bag it out. Had a chance to back the National Reconstruction Fund, opposed it. Had a chance to back energy price relief for manufacturers, opposed it. Had a chance to back tax cuts for manufacturing workers, opposed it, supported it, and then said they'll be doing something else about it down the track. Completely Order. Inconsistent. And always negative and always nasty. Labor wants people to earn more and keep more of what they earn. Those opposite want people to work longer for less.
Yeah. Call to the member for Deakin.
Mr. Speaker, my question is to the Prime Minister. Permanent long-term overseas arrivals are outpacing the construction of new homes at a rate of almost 4 to 1. With 900,000 net overseas arrivals, but only 265,000 building completions since Labor came to government. When will the Prime Minister admit Labor's housing crisis is out of control and Labor's fake promise to build 1.2 million homes is yet another broken promise? Why is the Prime Minister taking this country in the wrong direction?
Call to the Prime Minister. Order.
Thanks very much for
the member for Deakin's asked his question.
The member for Deakin, who's asked a question which is very broad ranging at the end there, but I thank him for the tag of, and I respond by saying Australia is indeed heading in the right direction. It was heading in the wrong direction, Mr. Speaker, but now it's heading in a direction which sees inflation going down. I think that's a good thing. It's heading in a direction where real wages are going up. I think that's a good thing. Productivity is increasing. I think that's a good thing. Now, instead of deficits under them, we've got surpluses. I think that's a good thing. And we've seen more jobs created under this government than in any new government in Australian political history. I think that's a good thing as well. The other thing that is a good thing is that every Australian's going to get a tax cut. Not just some, not just politicians, Every Australian, every worker, including those who are building and working on Australia's programs, such as the Social Housing Accelerator, which is seeing new public housing built, such as those who are benefiting from the tax changes put in by the Treasurer to encourage the private rental market and to encourage
the
construction
member for
in
Deakin
that,
is
such
now
as
warm.
Those Australians who will benefit from the Housing Australia Future Fund, which those opposite were completely horrified by, and they voted against. They voted against, and of course, when it comes to the population of Australia, as the population statement said last December, for 2030-31, the expected population is 600,000 below what was projected prior to the onset of the pandemic in 2019-2020. And we, of course, note the comments of the Leader of the Opposition, who said, we do need, in September 2022, we do need an increase in the migration numbers. It's clear that the number needs to be higher. That's what he had to say. A month later, he said, we need migration, we need migration, just to really emphasise it.
Order.
In his first budget reply, he boasted, I brought in record numbers of people from India, China and many other countries. The Deputy Leader has said, we know that urgently business needs a workforce, and much of that workforce needs to come from overseas. The Shadow Minister sitting next to him there said, we
Order.
Need to get our international students back.
Prime Minister's
the
hypocrisy time has concluded. Order. The member for Wannan. Call to the honourable member for Hunter.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Health. What actions has the Albanese Labor government taken to make medicines cheaper for all Australians? How are 60-day prescriptions helping patients with ongoing illness? And why wasn't this introduced earlier?
Call to the Minister for Health and Aged Care.
Well, thank you, Speaker, and I thank the member for Hunter for his question because, like everyone on this side of the House, he has no higher priority than helping his community with the cost of living by earning more and by keeping more of what they earn. I'm pleased to say, Mr. Speaker, last year healthcare workers saw their wages rise by an average of 5.5%, well over double what they were seeing under those opposite. And they'll get to keep more of that money, Mr. Speaker, when every single one of them receives a tax cut on the 1st of July. Like a third-year RN in the members' electorate working at the Cessnock Hospital, who get a tax cut of more than $1,600, or double what they would have got under the old plan. But the member for Hunter also promised cheaper medicines to his community, Mr. Speaker, and we have delivered on that as well, like lower annual medicine bills for millions of pensioners and the biggest cut to the price of medicines last year
Order.
In the 75-year history of the PBS. But we've also been determined, Mr. Speaker, to allow hundreds and hundreds of common medicines for ongoing health conditions to be supplied for 60 days at the cost of a single script, saving up to 6 million patients' time and even more money, Mr. Speaker. It's not a new idea. Most other countries we compare ourselves already do it, and the medicines experts advised the former government to do it more than 5 years ago, Mr. Speaker. But they rejected the advice, and instead millions of patients have paid hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars for their medicines, more than they should have done. Well, we did accept the advice, Mr. Speaker, and 3 weeks ago I added 94 more medicines to that 60-day script list, like menopause medicines used by about 600,000 Australian women, like diabetes medicines used by well over a million Australian patients, and medicines used by tens and tens of thousands of breast cancer survivors to prevent a recurrence of their cancer, just to name a few, Mr. Speaker. And remember, Mr. Speaker, the opposition voted against all of this. The opposition voted against all of this, perhaps unsurprising given it's an opposition led by a man who, as health minister, actually tried to jack up the price of medicines, not to bring them down in his first budget. But I don't only want to thank the member for Hunter for his support and commitment to cheaper medicines. He has also been a fierce advocate for a strong community pharmacy sector in the Hunter Valley, Mr. Speaker. And I know that he's delighted that we've reached a deal to invest up to an additional $3 billion to deliver cheaper medicines, to deliver better patient outcomes and a strong community pharmacy sector. Now, those opposite pretended you could only have one or the other. You can only have cheaper medicines or a strong pharmacy sector, but our negotiations have delivered both. That's what a strong, responsible government does.
Call the Prime Minister. Prime Minister has the call.
Thanks, Mr. Speaker. I ask for the questions to be placed on the notice paper. And